It's one small step for man.
There is no planet B.
I stand here today humbled.
You turn if you want to.
I will not be lectured about sexism.
The winner is Cindy.
This week in history.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one.
MDS,
we have ignition, we have a liftoff.
Roll program is in on time. Vehicle response is normal.
And there went Voyager 1, which was launched into space on September the 5th, 1977, which today, 49 years later, is still travelling deep in space. In fact, it's the most distant human-made object to have been made on Earth. In fact, it's gone so far into space that on the 18th of November this year, it's going to find itself a full light day away from Earth at a distance of some 25.9 billion kilometres away from us. Hard to get your head around that, isn't it? Well, I'm very excited to tell you that with us tonight to talk about Voyager 1 and 2, I've got one of the original scientists who worked on the mission with us. Now, Dr. Gary Hunt was part of Voyager's imaging team, which was responsible for the spacecraft's cameras and for the images that it returned to Earth. He is with us here on Nightlife in This Week in History. Hello, Gary. Welcome.
Thank you very much, and it's a delight to be speaking to you.
And I suppose having had personal involvement, Gary, I mean, literally, you can take yourself back 49 years ago today and yesterday and think about what that was like. Where were you at the moment of the launch?
Well, I was for Voyager 2, which is the first one in August. I was actually there, and that was actually both exciting and scary because it was launched. It looked wonderful. And then suddenly one of my friends came around and said, "Hang on, we've got a meeting in 5 minutes. We've got a problem." And we did have a problem with Voyager 2 almost immediately after launch. It should open up completely. If you look at the scan platform, it should all click into place. But it didn't. And what they actually cleverly had to do was to spin the spacecraft a bit faster, and it clicked into position. It was all right, which meant changes had to be made for Voyager 1. I was back in JPL in California for that launch in September. But quite honestly, Suzanne, if you said to me, did you think it would still be working now? We never thought it wouldn't. It was never a question. My own involvement goes back right the way back to 1970 when I came to America from Oxford, started working at JPL, then submitted a proposal, and somehow, out of the thousands that wanted to be involved, I was chosen, the only British person at that stage ever to be selected. So it was a rather special date.
Yeah.
And I was told, actually, on my wife's birthday, so it's a better, good birthday present too.
Now, you've mentioned JPL a couple of times. What does that stand for?
Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is the...
Okay.
The finest laboratory you can possibly imagine in Pasadena, California. I still interact with them even to this day, all these years later. It is a fantastic place to work.
Yeah. So, I know you know you just had those initial memories, but it must be an extraordinary feeling for you to have been part of something so historic, and you must have been aware of the history-making potential of it at the time.
Well, not so much because, you know, it was only Jupiter and Saturn at the time it was launched. It was funded. The president was Nixon. He had very firm views that nobody else was going to get credit for things that he did. So we only went as far as Saturn. And our major objective was getting to Titan because we all thought Titan could be an interesting Earth-like planet, satellite, one of the major satellites of Saturn. And We thought perhaps this is one that has the sort of atmosphere, the sort of molecules that led to the development of our own environment. So that was one of our objectives. But then other things happened thereafter. But those are early stages. And one thing, just to put the whole age thing into perspective, when I wrote my proposal, my elder daughter was coming up to 5. When we got to Neptune all those years later, she was at Cambridge doing her PhD, and she came to work for me. And it's gone one stage further because a few weeks ago, my little six-year-old granddaughter won a Lego competition. And what did she make? A model of Voyager.
Very much staying in the family. Now, look, you've kind of explained what the thinking was.
Well, the whole point was it was a set of instruments. But up to that stage, space exploration had been going to Venus, going to have a look at Mars, being quite simple in what you're doing. This was a chance to go further. Could we get past the asteroids? Could we actually get to these further places? Did they hold the clues to the origin of life? That was one of our objectives. Were there other people out there like us? We didn't know. So this was a big, bold opportunity. But you've got to realise how it came about. Because in 1961, a PhD student at UCLA actually spotted that the planets had a special alignment, something that occurs every 175 years. So that was one very important thing. And then the whole concept that perhaps you could use a spacecraft to get there. But this was the issue. It was on a straight, or virtually a sort of straight line. And as each spacecraft passed a planet, it gained energy from the planet. We actually have slowed Jupiter down. Then it moved on to Saturn and so on. So it was a unique opportunity to get to the furthest part of the solar system easily. If you wanted to go in now and try and get to Neptune, it wouldn't take the 12 years it took us. It will take decades. So this was shortening the trip to get to the depths of the outer solar system to learn what is there. Does it give clue to the origin about the Earth, how the Earth developed, about us, and all the basic factors that we wanted to know? And really, it's taken us to a level we can't imagine.
Yeah. I've got Dr. Gary Hunt with me. Gary was part of Voyager's imaging team back in the 1970s. Okay, so just talk to us a bit more detail, Gary, about this rare planetary alignment, which kind of, you know, super sped Voyager's through the solar system. What exactly went on that made that possible?
Well, it's just the way the solar system rotates and the way that the stability occurs. So these things will occur, and they occur every 175 years. But it's one stage further than that. To actually launch and be able to gain the benefit of this rare planetary alignment, we had 10 days. We had 10 days between getting Voyager 1 up and Voyager 2 up and then Voyager 1 up. So this is not a chance of making a mistake. Please, sir, can I have a bit more time, which is the usual approach for doing projects in this modern world. We had to make sure that from the word go, we had 5 years to develop the spacecraft, to develop the instruments, to get everything organized, to get them on the launch pads and get them launched up. And we did it.
Wow. Now, Voyager 2 was launched 16 days earlier than Voyager 1. Why was that the case? And why, if Voyager 2 was going first, did it get called 2 and not 1?
Well, it may look like we're having a sort of a crazy idea. But the whole purpose was Titan was the most important thing to look at. So there were various orbits that you could take. We actually had to choose the two trajectories for the spacecraft to go on out of 10,000 possibilities. I'm not a gambling man, so it was a hard job, but we somehow did it. So by launching Voyager 2 on its path and Voyager 1 on another path, Voyager 1 would actually get to Titan first, but Voyager 2 will have a trajectory past Titan. We give it better ways to take observations than the previous one. The first one would be to show Titan had interesting things, and then Voyager 2 would exploit that and get a better range of observations so that we perhaps can learn more. Okay. So these things are very carefully designed.
And is that because they had different equipment or because of the different approaches
that
they were taking?
They had identical equipment. It was just the way you passed by and what you could see, and it had to be done in this particular way. And that's why the whole funding, the mission was originally called Mariner Jupiter Saturn, MJS, and only became Voyager at the time of launch. It was a name change. These paths were very carefully trajectoried. And if you think back, I said there were 10,000 possible trajectories that we could choose. If you take the imaging team as an example, we weren't astronomers. I'm not an astronomer. My background is in atmospheric physics. I'm there to understand the meteorology. The weather systems on Jupiter and Saturn are absolutely incredible. We still don't understand many of them. And on board, you also have some wonderful geologists. So we had a whole range of different scientific skills to look at these objects as detailed scientists as we would look at the Earth. Whereas before, people have been astronomers, and therefore they would just be taking a quick picture saying, oh, look, there's a crater there, or there's something there's a cloud there. They would not be able to quantify it. This was a tremendous new step for the American Space Agency and the way that space exploration was done. And it has, in fact, changed the whole way in which we now do our space exploration.
Now, the Voyager craft were famous for the golden records that they had on board. Tell us about these records and what was on them.
Well, the first thing you would say is, why do you want one? Well, the whole purpose is we're going to somewhere where we don't know what's out there. We know ultimately it's going to drift away from our or everything that we know. And if you've got a messenger, you want to have something on board that says something about it. First of all, we want to make sure that we're friendly. We have to be a bit worried. We've always been a bit worried. It could get captured, if that's the right word, by somebody who is rather hostile. So the whole purpose of this was a golden record that would tell whoever, whatever, captures Voyager at some distant stage, where it came from, the sort of people that live there. There are 115 images of our Earth and our environment and us. There are 35 sounds of the Earth, all the various animal sounds that you can think of. There are greetings in 55 languages, including English spoken by an American, which we object to. But the 90 minutes of music ranging from Mozart and Beethoven to pop music, and the whole spectrum, a message by President Carter, who was the president at the time. There was a message by the Secretary General of the United Nations, and a diagram that really explains all about us, where we come from. We use the whole evidence of the hydrogen atom so we can actually learn about the whole question of time and the scientific symbols that tell us about the spacecraft and the path of which we are taken. So it's a very good idea. Carl Sagan was the driver behind this, and it's an excellent idea. And also on board, more importantly, are a set of messages that enables whoever, whatever captures it, how to play it. So it's a very, very important way in which we can say, this is us and we're friendly.
I've got Dr. Gary Hunt here. Do you think there is life out there somewhere, Gary?
Statistically, it has to be. It would be quite extraordinary if we are the only people in anywhere around. There's got to be something somewhere. We're only scratching at the edge. I will be very, very surprised. But will I ever know? The answer is probably not. So we've got to keep looking. We've got to have this imagination. We've got to have this desire to find out what's out there. But you and I have all seen now how clever robots are. They can already beat the 100 meters record. That's a good start, isn't it? So the robots are the way things are going. So who knows what's out there? But like you, I grew up with my comics, my Dan Deere and the Mekon and all other things that other people have read. And we're always saying, yes, there must be something out there. And I'd be surprised if Voyager or somebody else doesn't find something.
Dr. Gary Hunt is here with us. He was part of Voyager's imaging team, which was responsible for the cameras on Voyagers 1 and 2. So just talk to us, as Voyager 1 left and Voyager 2, what in those initial few years did we learn that that was a big surprise to us back here on Earth?
I'll tell you, one of the questions that people always ask me is, what is your favourite picture? What is the most important picture? And I'll surprise you. The most important picture was the little blue dot that we took at the end. That's the family picture. We turned the camera system round and we took the picture of the entire solar system looking back. It shows everything from Mercury right the way through out to Neptune with a tiny, tiny little blue dot in the middle. That's the Earth. And why is that so important? That shows you that our planet is no more than a tiny speck amongst the stars. And therefore, we've got to take great care of our environment, not make a great mess of the climate as we're doing at the moment. And so that is a very, very important mechanism and a very, very important picture. But it was actually quite difficult to persuade our lords and masters who write the checks that this is an important thing to do. They thought that was a bit of a flippant thing. And so we fought like crazy to get it done. And quite honestly, I think this picture is so, so important, particularly at the moment where there is clearer evidence of the changing in climate.
Yeah. Now, that happened in 1990 because that's when Voyager 1's cameras were set to be shut down. So was it always the plan that the cameras would be shut down at that point?
Well, they had to be shut down. In fact, all the scientific instruments on the scan platform were shut down. And we're just left with the others, which will monitor the environment around. And there's two or three of them are still working now, measuring cosmic rays, measuring plasma densities, the environment in which the spacecraft is working. But Voyager is moving away from the Earth. It's moving away from the Sun. So it has to carry its own power. It carries its own sort of nuclear power station. It has plutonium-238, which is decaying, and it's giving up electrical energy at a rate of about 4 watts a day. So slowly, slowly, it's using up energy. And this is our great concern, that gradually Voyager is going to run out of power. And people say, will Voyager come to an end? Actually, we may never know. There's just been a brilliant piece of engineering work done on the 9th of July when they managed to change some of the power systems around, keep the heaters going, to keep the spacecraft operating a bit longer. But there's going to come a time when, although the deep space network on the ground is capable of receiving a signal, the spacecraft itself won't have the power to send it. And that is going to be a sad day. When will that be? Think about 2035.
2035? Oh, my goodness.
Sorry, 2035.
Oh, 20. I'm saying that's extraordinary if it can go for another 110 years.
I sincerely hope that I'm here to be part of it. And indeed, that is one of the sad things, that there's so few of us originals who were very, very young when we were selected, who are still capable of being involved now. Mm. But this is one of the great, great issues. And in fact, one thing I would like to pass to you and your listeners is that as Voyager comes gradually to its end, how should it end? We can't be like Cassini and go crashing into Saturn, which was spectacular. But we could send it some music, a message, something nice. It'd be interesting to know what your listeners would suggest that we did.
So when you say it's going to come to an end, I mean, do you mean, you know, what are the options? I mean, could it just run out of power and drift through the universe? Or will you find a way of destroying it?
No, we will never destroy it, because it's our messenger. It's our messenger to the stars. It's humanity's greatest journey. It will simply run out of power. It will not be able to send a signal strong enough for the deep space network to pick up. That's a very important issue to note, is that to receive the signals, we use satellite systems, the deep space network. The main one is Goldstone in California. There's one in Madrid. And there's a very, very important one in Canberra, Australia. Now, for Voyager 2, Canberra is absolutely key. The path of Voyager 2 is very low in the sky, and Canberra is the major place which receives the weak signal back here on Earth. So please take care of it.
Right. So where's Voyager 2 in comparison to Voyager 1 at the moment?
Oh, gosh. incredible distances away. Voyager 1 is just coming up to one light day away. Sounds a long way, is it? But not by astronomical terms. Voyager 2 is not quite so far, but in totally different parts of the sky. Their trajectories were very, very different. So they're very different parts of the sky, but they are an incredible distance away. So Voyager 1 is one light day. Voyager 2 is not quite as far.
Now, Gary, I'm still just puzzling over the question of what's actually going to happen to Voyager 1 when the power does run out. Will it just sit there, just stay where it is space?
It will just carry on drifting along its path, happily enjoying itself. I assume that's the right word to use, but it will just drift through space.
What are the currents or that will make it drift? I mean, will something pull it? It's not kind of like it's on a river, is it? Or, you know, to go downstream. Power,
it has its own energy. It has its own momentum. And it will carry on. And there is gravity out there of a weaker sort, but it will just glide on its path. It can't drop out of anything. So what can it drop out of? And so it's just carrying on its same path, but sadly unable to communicate. And that's the sad thing. It could communicate, but the signal is just so weak. You cannot imagine how weak it is, and that nothing can be done about it.
So,
and quite honestly, I think the other thing to emphasise is that you're talking to me as a scientist, and we've learnt so much from a scientific point of view, but the real medals should be pinned on the chest of the engineers who constantly have kept the spacecraft going. We've talked about the cameras just after the Saturn encounter, the whole scan platform system jammed up. We would have lost every possible observation had that not been repaired. And it was only repaired by sheer brilliance. And we can't send out an engineer in his car to go and repair it. The spacecraft's beyond Saturn. But over a period of time, they were able to repair it. And lots of other tricks like that have been played. The engineers involved with this mission from the very beginning, the way it's been managed, have been absolutely first class. This has shown the real strength, the real capability. And also, it's also a good example about wealth creation. All our nations talk about space science or astronomy and these activities. They're gimmickry. That's wasting money. No, it's not. All of us have got skills. We have, and we've used them. We've brought up knowledge and we've gone on. In my own case, I went into business and ran the major companies and advised governments, even came to Australia and did the same there. So we've got transitional skills. This is the real legacy of Voyager, not just the science, and it's the engineering, the project management, and the transitional skills of everybody involved.
Now, Gary, you were saying the signal now is so weak, but then you said, you know, the engineers did manage to, I think, turn off some instruments, I think it was earlier this year, you know, in order to save some power. I mean, how do you do that from 25.9 billion kilometres away? Do you have to rely on that incredibly weak signal to send instructions to it?
Well, it's a bit like the human body. They're constantly being monitored. They constantly be able to model the way in which the energy flow is being operated, and they can model what would happen if certain tasks were played. So this is where the secret of engineering is not simply with a spanner and tightening up this, that, and the other. These pieces of equipment are under constant monitor. You take your car in to be serviced. They plug in and they will find out what's wrong with the engine. We're doing that remotely on these spacecraft
But just literally using this very weak signal that's coming to us from a light day away.
That's the other problem, is that can you imagine sending me a message to carry out a particular task when that message takes, in the case of Voyager 1, one light day to get there and one light day to get back? An example was... about a year ago, we were having trouble communicating with with the Voyager 1 spacecraft, because the antenna had somehow managed to get slightly out of position, and it was sending a message to somebody else. They probably didn't know what it was anyhow. But and it was just able, they were just able to move the antenna back so it would communicate back to the Earth. But just think, it took 24 hours to get that signal out there and 24 hours to send it back. So even though you have made the change that you felt was perfect, you had an awful lot of worrying to take before you were sure it happened. And everything we have done, as we've gone from Jupiter to Saturn to Uranus to Neptune, it's got further and further and further and further away. We were trying to make real-time decisions on Neptune because we had seen interesting features on the planet. We had seen nitrogen geysers on Triton and thought, my goodness, that's extraordinary. But to get our equipment pointing in the right direction, we had an eight-hour time shift in each direction. So you have to have good faith, and of course it did work.
That's right. Yeah, let's just move that camera around, okay? Sort of 8 hours later, to work? Yeah.
It's even worse than that, Suzanne, because, I'm an atmospheric scientist. I'm interested in things moving. I'm next to brilliant geologists who want to see every little spot on the ground. So there is a little internal battle, and we have to work between ourselves, and that was it. We had a wonderful team, very, very sharp people, but we knew how to balance the trade-off between what I want to do and what somebody else wants to do, and it works.
Yeah. So are you still, actively involved? I mean, do you get updates? Are you still talking to the people who are controlling or communicating with Voyager today?
I do, indeed. I at least once a week, I'm in regular contact. I'm still on the board of organizations in Pasadena, and I still regularly talk there. Yes, Voyager is very much my life. If anything happens or is about to happen, I'm informed directly. When we did the Big Bang to change over the power systems on board in July, I was in contact with JPL. Yes, they're very much part of my life. And until a few years ago, when I stopped doing a lot of international travel, I would always be in JPL, which is quite an extraordinary factor when you think I was sort of 28 when I went there. And now in this great age, I'm still padding around the place. It's extraordinary.
As you say, very much your life's work, Gary. Thank you so much for being here on Nightlife to talk to us about the 49th anniversary of the launch of Voyager 1.
Thank you, Suzanne. It's been a pleasure to speak to you all.
Dr. Gary Hunt, who was part of Voyager's imaging team, the team that was responsible for the spacecraft's cameras and for the images that it returned to Earth.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.